Welcome, folks, to the Friday, June 14th courtroom drama episode of On Iowa Politics. This week, we'll talk about federal court hearings over a pair of new state laws. Iowa Republicans weigh in on another criminal conviction in presidential circles. And the bird flu is jumping species. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. With me this week, our Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief, Tom Barton. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Aaron.
Lee Des Moines Bureau Chief Caleb McCullough is with us. Hello, Caleb.
Hello, Aaron.
Checking in from Davenport is Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Hello, Sarah.
Greetings, Aaron.
And on the opposite side of the state is Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. Hello, Jared.
Aaron, despite what you might have been told, we can all still see your likes on Twitter. So just a heads up on that.
Misinformation was that? Uh-oh. No, that's bad news. I may have to go back and undo some. I thought they were private. Finally, Gazette columnist Todd Dorman is with us. Hello, Todd.
Hey.
All right. We start this week in federal court, where two new Iowa state laws were the focus of separate hearings. First, on Monday at the federal courthouse here in Des Moines, where I am, a federal judge heard arguments over the new immigration law that makes it a state crime to be in Iowa illegally after having previously been deported or entered the country illegally. The law would give state and local law enforcement officials the ability to order and then conduct the deportation of anyone who violates that law. The federal judge who heard the argument said he plans to issue his ruling with some expedience, given that the law is set to take effect July 1. It's been passed, but it's not on the books yet. And as the judge acknowledged, the chances are virtually zero that his ruling will be the final stop in this law's legal battle. There's surely going to be an appeal. I was in the courtroom Monday for this hearing, and while I will qualify this with a gigantic, all caps, I am no legal scholar, it sure sounded to me like the judge is leaning toward granting at least a preliminary injunction to keep the law from going into effect while and a widely expected appeal is considered. Todd, let me start with you here. We know similar laws in other states like Texas and Oklahoma were passed there and also have been challenged in the courts. What's the end game to all this? Where's is this one that's going to go to the Supreme Court? What's the end game here?
Yeah, I think the Texas law actually already got to the Supreme Court and they sent it back. For the Supreme Court didn't rule on the constitutionality of it. They basically sent it back to the appeals court and said, "You rule on the constitutionality and let us know how that goes." But yeah, you know, it's a tug of war between the federal government and the states, and it's you know, political because these are red state governors who are enacting these laws, you know, mainly as a thumb in the eye of President Biden and what they would argue is his inability to secure the border. But, you know, traditionally the federal government has had the purview over immigration. The Constitution even says that they're in charge of setting up a naturalization system. And really, it was in the late 1800s, and we had sort of the big push of immigration that the federal government, you know, really took over that function. So, I mean, the states are arguing. Well, Texas for sure is arguing that, you know, they're being invaded, and so they need to do these state things. The argument, I mean, Iowa doesn't have that argument. But I think in the end, yeah, this judge is going to do an injunction. I don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do, but I wouldn't be surprised if in the end they decide to keep a system that's federally run rather than have a, you know, sort of a patchwork of every, you know, every state along the border having completely different immigration laws, which could be a real, you know, real hassle.
Yeah, that was, like I said, I was in the courtroom this week, and that was definitely a good chunk of the argument that the attorneys were making for the two parties that are challenging this law, one being the federal government, and another being an immigration advocacy group. And they kind of talked about, like you said, that this has typically been the purview of the federal government. And they argued for good reason, because it would be a absolute mess if you had 50 different states, 50 different immigration policies. And then they also talked about how federal law guarantees certain things to immigrants and in immigration enforcement. And now you're trying to turn that over to state and local officials who don't have that, you know, working knowledge or experience. Like I said, that was a big chunk of the case that the, I guess that would be the prosecution was making, the government and this advocacy group. Law is set to go into effect July 1. It sounded like well in advance of that we'll get that ruling. And you know, this is nothing more than a prediction just based on what I heard and trying to read between the lines, but it sure sounded like that headed for an injunction. And then, again, assuming that gets bumped up to appeals court. Speaking of which, in another courtroom, this one in Minnesota on Tuesday, a federal appeals court heard arguments over Iowa's sweeping K-12 education bill from 2023. And that bill, among other things, banned from K-12 public schools any books with depictions of sex acts. And that same federal judge who handled Monday's hearing on the immigration law previously heard arguments on this K-12 books and curriculum law. Judge Stephen Locker ordered a temporary pause on that one too, and now it's at the appeals court. Tom, you followed Tuesday's appeals court discussion on this K-12 books and curriculum law, and once again offering the caveat about my legal expertise here, but it sounded to me, anyways, from reading your story, like the appeals court justices seem skeptical that this law violates the First Amendment to the Constitution and that this one might get overturned. But that's my reading. Tell me what you heard and what was interesting about that, Tom.
Yeah, so a three-member panel of federal appeals court judges heard arguments about whether to uphold that lower court ruling blocking the Iowa law, which, as you mentioned, bans books and curriculum depicting or describing sex acts from school libraries or classrooms with the exemption of religious texts. It also prohibits programs, promotion, and instruction about sexual orientation and gender identity in kindergarten through sixth grade outside of health curriculum. So the judges appeared reticent based on their questioning of attorneys during nearly a half hour of arguments to affirm the district court's order granting the preliminary injunction. They didn't so much seem skeptical as to whether the law violates free speech rights under the First Amendment as they questioned the scope of the challenge of the state law. So in questions raised during oral arguments, Judge James Loken appeared to criticize the groups suing the state for bringing a facial challenge, that is, a claim that the law is entirely unconstitutional based on how it was written, instead of challenging how the law has been applied. And Judge Ralph Erickson suggested litigants should take small bites and try to slap it down piece by piece by suing individual school districts and stating some schools may be applying the law too broadly. He said certain books that have been removed from some schools, such as 1984, Animal Farm, and A Portrait of Dorian Gray, you know, he said, probably seem to have artistic merits such that application of this statute is inappropriate. Judge Loken, though, did question, he said, why does the First Amendment care if a book is removed from a school library, as long as it's still available at a local bookstore? It's, I guess, worth noting that the district court ruling was made in response to two separate legal challenges that argue that the law silences LGBTQ students from expressing their identities and restricts students free access to information. So an attorney representing book publishers said school libraries are intended to provide access to books for all children, regardless of whether they can buy it at a bookstore, and that students have a right to receive information that is age appropriate. The law, though, makes no differentiation as to what is appropriate for certain grade levels. So the attorney for Penguin Random House said, for example, books that might be fully appropriate for a 12th grader might not be for a 9th grader or a 6th grader or even a, you know, 3rd grader or a kindergartner. However, the law makes no distinction in that regard. He also disagreed with Judge Erickson and Iowa Solicitor General Eric Wesson, who argued for the lower court injunction to be overturned, claiming that, you know, that there are routes for as applied challenges to the state law. He said that the question before the court is not whether some of the books that you know, state defendants can point to may be constitutionally removed from school districts. They can, and they have been under existing law. The question, he argued, that's before the court is whether the law, which the lower court deemed to be overbroad and vague, is constitutional. And Christy Hickman, an attorney for the Iowa State Education Association, the teachers union, who's part of another lawsuit challenging the state law, said that the court needs to weigh in on the law because guidance from state education officials is limited and school districts don't seem to agree on how it's supposed to work. You know, they've noted that the law has resulted in the removal of several hundreds of books, including, among others, nonfiction history books, classic works of fiction, Pulitzer Prize winning novels, and books meant to help students avoid being victimized by sexual assault. It should be noted that since the injunction, many books and resources initially pulled from Iowa classrooms and school libraries have been returned. But the attorney for the teachers union said, you know, if you look at kind of the extreme disparity across school districts and the number and types of books that have been removed, it shows that there's a lot of confusion and ambiguity in interpretation, and that if plaintiffs had to start suing individual school districts, she said, you know, think about the court and school and public resources that would have to go into that. Now, the Iowa Solicitor General, who's, you know, representing the state, argued that that Iowa has the ability to tell schools to remove books that show or describe sex acts as defined in criminal code because, according to him, library curation is government speech. And so his contention was that this law regulates government, not private speech, and such there's no First Amendment harm as a result. He also said that, you know, the lower court used an overly broad reading of the law to find what he termed to be constitutional infirmities to halt enforcement, and that state and federal courts actually require a narrower reading. For example, despite how the law is written, he argued it does not apply to books related to gender identity and sexuality, only to mandatory or compulsory instruction in certain grades.
Yeah, interesting. And I wanted to go back, because when I covered the original arguments on this, you could hear the seeds being sown about that whole discussion about books and that maybe schools are being overly broad in applying the law. So I found that really fascinating that really got flushed out there at the appeals court level. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, Tom, because I can't remember either. The one judge you said that some of the schools may be misapplying the law because some of the books that they're pulling would have literary value, but the law doesn't account for that as an exception, does it? Or am I misremembering that?
It does not. And that was an argument made by attorneys for Lambda Legal and the ACLU. Yeah. And I think the attorney representing book publishers maybe also made this argument, but yeah, they say that, you know, the books that have been removed under that age appropriate standard are not pornography and fail to meet the definition of obscenity as determined by the U.S. Supreme Court. Their suit argues that the law prohibits books without any evaluation of the material as a whole or its literary, artistic, political, or scientific value.
Right. Interesting. Well, and then speaking of this, Jared and Sarah, I wanted to loop you guys in real quick on this too, because we, as Tom mentioned, we've seen books pulled off of shelves, and then in some cases, some were put back. I don't know how much y'all have each covered this in or your papers in your area, but I'm just wondering how much of an impact this law has made in schools in the Quad Cities and in Western Iowa there, because it's been interesting, because even though the judge halted implementation of the law, technically it's on pause. The law is not into effect. We saw schools doing this across the state throughout this past school year, removing books from their shelves in fear of violating the law. Sarah, did that happen in the Quad Cities?
Yeah, so we haven't done like a comprehensive assessment of how many books have been removed or put back since that injunction was put in place. But I do know that there were 9 books removed from Davenport schools. Credit to the Des Moines Register for putting together that comprehensive list of putting out FOIAs to school districts. So that's where I got this information. Typical books that we've seen over and over again on these lists, like Genderqueer, All Boys Aren't Blue, A Handmaid's Tale, Sold, A Court of Mist and Fury. So 9 books in Davenport. It's not clear if they put those back or not. And then Olivia Allen, our education reporter, she was reporting on a Pleasant Valley School District school board meeting where it sounded like one of the board directors had asked, well, we removed some books from the shelves, like where are those at now? And Pleasant Valley had returned some books to the shelves after the injunction. But the other schools in our area, I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, interesting. Jared, how about over your way?
Well, Aaron, let me crack my knuckles here, do some stretching, because we got a laundry list.
Oh, boy.
So again, all from the Des Moines Register, as Sarah mentioned, yeah, which is an invaluable thing they put together. Alta Aurelia had 56 books pulled, all of which were then reshelved. Central Lion had 67 items pulled, including Brave New World, which of course is a dystopian novel, Ridgeview High School, which is Galva, Holstein, Schaller, Crestlin, had 64 books pulled, including Slaughterhouse-Five, which is an anti-war book by Kurt Vonnegut. They also pulled The Color Purple. One of the books pulled in Mason City, my old stomping grounds, was An American Tragedy by Theodore Dreiser, which the American Library Association has noted was burned in 1930s Germany. 2 were pulled in Okoboji, both of which were reshelved. Pocahontas had 32 pulled, including 1984, Animal Farm, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, and Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. There were 12 in River Valley, 40 in Sioux Center, 63 in Spencer, including Of Mice and Men, which was reshelved, along with a number of others. One that was not reshelved, and this speaks to something Tom was talking about with history books, was the nonfiction book, The Rape of Nanking, which is about the atrocities that were committed by the Imperial Japanese Army in China from 1937 to 1938. And then there were 24 that were pulled in Spirit Lake.
Yeah, so there you have it. And that, like you said, that's interesting where you have some of those dishes and then like literally all of them were put back on the shelves after a review, so.
Yeah, and I should note none in Sioux City at all. Not a single one pulled or reshelved. So
interesting. And obviously, now we wait for the appeals court decision and see where that goes. But obviously, a law that's already having impact, even though it's not even technically on the books. All right, moving on to our third federal courtroom in this week's episode, and I didn't do the legwork on this, but that has to be a new On Iowa Politics podcast record. This week, Hunter Biden, the son of President Joe Biden, was convicted on charges related to him buying a gun while addicted to drugs. As we discussed on last week's podcast, when former President Donald Trump was recently convicted of 34 felony counts of financial fraud in New York, Iowa Republicans and Republicans more broadly rushed to Trump's defense and decried the legal system that led to his conviction. Caleb, what did Iowa Republicans have to say this week about Hunter Biden's conviction?
Well, if you were hoping that the conviction balanced the scales and declared a bias-free Justice Department, you would be mistaken. Our Republican members of Congress, said we're largely in line with the national Republican with several national Republicans who said, they reiterated arguments, all of them that spoke on it, that the initial plea deal that Biden was offered was overly generous, and kind of argued that nobody else would have received that deal. So, that was an example of bias, and it didn't change their belief, that the Justice Department was politically motivated against Trump. But Chuck Grassley, and a couple others said that justice, they were glad that justice has been served in this case. Grassley has been a frequent critic of Hunter Biden. He aired unverified claims that Hunter and President Biden were involved in a bribery scheme with a Ukrainian energy CEO. The source of that information was indicted later by the FBI for lying about that story. But Grassley said that the conviction doesn't change his view that Trump is being politically persecuted. And he kind of delineated the way that he thinks that Trump's charges were motivated by him running for re-election. And that is why those charges were brought. And that's why he's, facing all those prosecutions. Whereas he says he didn't see that in the Hunter Biden prosecution, that was something that was motivated by the election.
Technically Hunter Biden is not running for election, right?
So that is correct. Yes. and I think we've noted this before, but when it comes to Trump's prosecutions, the two non-federal prosecutions were being led by Democratic DAs, but they were also brought by a grand jury, the indictments. And then at the federal level, of course, those were also brought by a grand jury. And Jack Smith is a special counsel who's independent of Biden's Justice Department. So a lot of different moving parts there, but that was the general line.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed out, and I saw the same thing, a lot of the comments saying, focusing on the original plea deal that was proposed and Republicans saying that no one would have ever gotten that sweet of a plea deal. You know who else didn't get that sweet of a plea deal? Hunter Biden, ultimately. So
yeah, and that was because the judge just rejected the deal. That there was a group between the prosecutors and Biden's lawyers, but the judge said that we're not going to go with this.
Right, or another way to say that may be that the legal system worked as intended. Right,
checks and balances.
All right, a bonus, a fourth trial to talk about this week. Some fresh news, man. This is, I feel like Judge Wapner here hosting today. Jared, you've got more to tell us about Steve King's latest legal battles with the Success Kid meme. As I said, as I understand, fresh off the presses here as we're recording Thursday afternoon, right?
Yes, indeedy. Journal reporter Nick Kittrick had a story Thursday that a federal appeals court upheld a $750 judgment against Steve King's Steve King's campaign committee for using a photo that had the Success Kid meme without permission in a fundraising ad. It was a three-judge panel on the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that denied King for Congress's arguments that it had an implied license to use the Success Kid meme, that King and his campaign were protected by fair use. A little bit of the background on this. In 2021, the Success Kid's family, the Brenner family, sued King and his campaign for copyright infringement. And their son sued for invasion of privacy after no one from Steve King's campaign contacted them about compensation. And they initially had sought a $150,000 damage judgment.
First of all, just brilliant that this whole thing is over $750. Let's not let that go without a reminder. And we can do this now. The last time we weren't up on the YouTubes yet. Now we are. We can give a visual help for those of us who are listening that way. The Success Kid meme is the little baby kid, but yeah, with like the victory fish shake. Yep.
Yes.
So if anybody's wondering what we're talking about there, that's that one. How old would he be now, Jared? Do you know?
Oh man, I should have double checked on that beforehand.
I didn't think to ask that until just now.
Gotta be like a teenager at this point, I would think.
Yeah, at least. I mean, I'm sure that meme's pushing 10 years old. Yeah.
Let's see. So in real time, 17.
There you go.
That was of last year, so maybe 18 now.
Okay. All right. So is that, by the way, so is that for that trial, Jared, or is TBD? Well, I'm sorry if you said.
Unless it gets sent up to an even higher level of the federal court system.
We can only hope. All right. Lastly this week, let's get out of the courtroom and get out on the farm and have a quick chat about the latest outbreak of the bird flu in Iowa. Because everything post-COVID is just plain weird now. The avian influenza has made the leap to dairy herds. That's right. The bird flu is affecting cows. I got nothing. Caleb, I think what most people are probably most interested to hear, if they hadn't already heard that, so if they're hearing this for the first time, is whether their milk is still okay. I know the answer to this, but because I've been reporting on this too, but I'll ask you, is it?
Yeah. If with an asterisk, if you bought your milk at the grocery store and it's pasteurized, yes.
Exactly. Keep going.
Yes. The alternative is raw milk, which is legal to sell directly to consumer in the state of Iowa as of last year when Republican lawmakers passed that law, is not advised. It wasn't advised before, but now it continues to be not great. Present health now hazards.
They strenuously object.
Right.
That's a Few Good Men reference, if anybody didn't pick that up. Keep going. Sorry.
A dairy extension vet at Iowa State, I was talking to him about this and asked him about raw milk. And he said that he basically said there's many things worse than the bird flu for you that you can catch from raw milk. But it's just one more reason not to roll the dice with that. So, milk's okay. The virus has been detected in three herds in the state as of yesterday sometime this week. It was first detected in cows in the U.S. in March. So it's the first time that the virus had made the jump to cows. It has been seen in mammals, wild mammals across the world in the last several decades. But this is the first time it's been found in domesticated cows here. So it presents a new challenge for federal and state regulators and farmers, because poultry farmers are used to kind of controlling for it and testing for it and being able to working with it, but this is just a new challenge that dairy farmers have to work with. So the state is working with the federal the USDA and other groups to test herds within the area of where it's been identified and figure out containment strategies and things like that.
So I guess now we wait to see if it heads towards the pigs, right? And threatens our bacon.
Yes. That is a possibility. And I think I've read a little bit that pigs are actually the biggest concern when it comes to human infection, because right now there have been a few human cases reported that were from dairy farm workers, and they were mild symptoms and they weren't very contagious. So that's, it doesn't at this point appear to be a concern as far as being a illness that we're going to have to deal with. But pigs, I've, was reading about the research that pigs are a particularly good host for new mutations of the virus that could make it closer to adaptations for humans. So that's, one more thing to worry about. But right now it does not seem to be too dangerous to humans.
Our, just to add on a little bit to some of what Caleb was saying, one of our reporters, Mason, he's working on a story. He's our business reporter. And one of the interesting tidbits that he pulled that I was not aware of is that the we don't necessarily know how much bird flu is in beef cows because they're not monitored as closely as dairy cows are. Dairy cows, because of, you know, the nature of like the product and everything, are monitored a lot more routinely and closely than beef cows are, which I thought was an interesting little thing to arise from some of the reporting so far.
That is, yeah, I hadn't encountered that. That's interesting.
And man, I shouldn't maybe do this because I can't remember for 100% sure, but I thought I remember reading that and the concern is a little less there because in cattle, ultimately they, you know, when they get processed and then when that product is cooked, that you've long since killed anything that people would have to worry about as far as moving it on to humans.
Well, especially if it's been cooked, that
right
is the key.
Yep. Sarah, you unmuted at one point. Did you have?
Oh, yes. I was just gonna say, you know, with the pigs being a particularly good host for mutations, you know, just want to say it's a good thing there aren't that many pigs in Iowa.
Yeah, right. Nothing to worry about there.
Not too many.
I don't know. I'm worried about the people. I'm worried about the bacon. I can get sick, but don't take away my bacon. All right. Well, all of these courses and all of these mutations of the bird flu and where it's going to hop to next, we'll keep an eye on it and talk about that in future episodes. But that's going to be it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. Appreciate you joining us. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice or on YouTube, where you should also smash that like button. By the way, hat tip to, do you know you guys play the New York Times daily game? So Wordle is obviously the big one. They also have one called Connections, where you try to group words into groups of four. every once in a while, they kind of mess with you. The first four words in Connections across the top row today were smash that like button. Smash it. Anyways, I thought that was clever. And of course, they all go to different categories, but they're feeling particularly clever today. You can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. Now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs, Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Victory Lap by Tone DeBoss is playing us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For the whole gang, Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Sarah Watson, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, and our producer Bailey Cheehan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Not a Gazette subscriber? There's no better time to support local journalism. View our latest deals for print and digital offerings at thegazette.com/subscribe. Stay informed. Be empowered. Subscribe to the Gazette today at thegazette.com/subscribe. Did you know that Gazette print subscribers have full access to digital content at no extra cost? Activate your digital subscription now to enjoy the latest headlines, sports updates, and more at thegazette.com or through the Gazette mobile app. Read the page-by-page daily newspaper with the Green Gazette, perfect for on-the-go reading. Activate your subscription at thegazette.com/activate or call 319-398-8333.